Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Last month, in a lawsuit by 12 California cities against gun manufacturers, this charge was made: that firearms companies knowingly shut their eyes to high-volume gun purchases, gun trafficking, and other schemes that get guns into the hands of criminals. Not a surprising accusation coming from, say, a gun control lobbying group. But this charge came from Robert Ricker, an attorney who not only spent his entire career promoting the interests of the NRA and of gun companies like Glock and Colt and Smith & Wesson, but who also wrote some of the first legislation in this country that granted gun manufacturers immunity from lawsuits like this one. Now he wants gun makers to abolish what he calls their hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil practices. To the NRA and his former employer, the American Shooting Sports Council, he is a turncoat. To the gun control lobby, Ricker is a devastating witness who's spilling the secrets of an industry that he knows intimately. Connection listeners, is it reasonable for the gun industry to protect itself against the misuse of firearms, including by criminals? Should any industry get this kind of blanket protection for the products it makes? Or could this be the kind of gauntlet that re-energizes a new round of debate over gun control? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me this hour from the NPR studios in Washington is Robert Ricker, longtime gun lobbyist who most recently served as the executive director of the nation's largest firearms trade organization. He is now a private consultant and lobbyist. Hi, Robert.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. We're going to be speaking with you in just a minute. But first on the line is Dave Limongiello. He is a former detective, with the Orange Police Department in Orange, New Jersey. He was shot in the line of duty more than 2 years ago. And also on the line with us is his attorney, John Lowy, of the Brady Center in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Dave, I want to ask you first, January 2001, what happened to you?
Well, in the Detective Bureau, we were doing a sting operation at a local gas station that was robbed around six times in a month period. We had a couple of officers inside the gas station, and there were a couple of detectives in unmarked vehicles around the gas station blocking off any exit in case a robbery did occur. At the time, an individual walked past the gas station. He didn't do anything. He appeared to be somewhat suspicious, but he did not make any move toward the gas station. My sergeant, who was inside the gas station, told me to wait until he got down a couple blocks away from the gas station so we don't compromise the investigation and find out who he is. You know, what's he doing in the area? As I approached the individual and got out of my car, I identified myself as a police officer, and at the time it was very cold, so he was wearing a lot of clothing, and I could not see his face. At this time, when I did identify myself and asked him to take his hands out of his pocket, he proceeded to shoot me three times.
And where were you injured? Where were you shot?
One of my lungs was collapsed. The lower part of my lung was destroyed. I was hit in my stomach and in my left arm.
And where did that gun come from?
It was one out of 12 guns later to find out that was purchased in West Virginia.
And do we know where?
A gun shop in West Virginia.
So a legal purchase, or do we know that?
Well, technically, the individual could have bought 150 guns, and he could have been legal. And that's the problem. You know, the way the gun was purchased was by a known gun trafficker who went in the store with a female and started pointing out which guns he wanted, then handed her thousands of dollars in cold cash, and then proceeded to purchase the weapons. After the weapons were purchased, the gun shop owner decided that something wasn't right and decided to call the ATF. Now, according to the NSSF, the National Sports Shooting Foundation, you know, that's procedure for them as far as straw purchasers, not to sell guns that way. And clearly that was the case in my instance.
And so who are you suing?
Along with the people who purchased the guns, the gun shop and the gun manufacturer, Stern Luger.
So clearly you want your day in court. Is there any other recourse for you if you don't get it?
I don't see any. Basically, they're trying to deny me my day in court. My right as an American to have my day in court. If this bill is passed, the immunity bill, it will deny me my day in court. You know, I spoke in front of Congress and the subcommittee a couple weeks ago, and, you know, I sat and listened to, you know, them trying to say that, you know, we're bankrupting the gun industry with all these frivolous lawsuits. Clearly, my case is not frivolous, and I am not trying to put anybody out of business. This is one manufacturer and one gun shop. It's not anything against the whole gun industry. I believe in the right to bear arms. I was a police officer, but clearly in my case there was negligence and irresponsibility, and they need to be held accountable.
John, I'm wondering, John Lowy from the Brady Center, in some sort of almost perverse way, do you think that this House resolution could in fact spark a new round of debate about gun control? Could it actually be something that turns out to be, I don't necessarily want to say a good thing for you, but certainly might refocus the argument?
Well, the argument clearly has to be refocused, and it should be, but the first step is to stop this really outrageous piece of special interest legislation that's moving through Congress, and we're up against a tough fight in the Senate to try to defeat it, but which we can win, and we hope we can win. But people should understand that what Congress is considering is to give the gun industry, manufacturers and dealers and trade associations, sweeping immunity from common law negligence and product liability principles that apply to everyone else in society. No other industry has anything like it. And as Dave told you, in his case, this gun dealer was clearly irresponsible by the industry's own guidelines. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. Yet, if Congress and the gun lobby, passes this bill, then this dealer would have immunity. And what you should also know is that a judge in West Virginia has already held that Dave Limoncello's case is supported by West Virginia common law. That under West Virginia law, that dealer and that manufacturer can be held liable in negligence and public nuisance. And so that decision by a state judge in West Virginia would be overturned if this bill were to pass.
All right. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. Dave Limoncello is a former detective with the Orange Police Department in Orange, New Jersey, and his attorney, John Lowy, of the Brady Center in Washington, D.C. Thank you both. Bob Ricker, let me go to you now. This legislation, I take it, is somewhat similar to some legislation that you got passed in California some time ago. Can you give us just some idea of the range of what's covered there? It's not blanket immunity. It is limited immunity.
It's not blanket, but it's as John Lowy said, it's sweeping immunity. The statute I wrote back in California in 1983 was much more limited and focused in on just one legal theory under the larger products liability theories. That statute was repealed a year and a half ago by the California state legislature.
So are you surprised that now here it is, a different version of it? The House passed it last Wednesday, pretty resoundingly.
It's not surprising. I mean, you know, with the political climate the way it is and the pretty much carte blanche that the NRA has now with Congress, that part is not surprising to me. But what is surprising to me is the breadth of the statute. I mean, it will probably, if it passes, gun manufacturers will no longer have any incentives to make quality firearms. I mean, and it's bad not only for you know, brave law enforcement officers like Dave Limoncello, but also for rank and file sportsmen who depend upon the industry to have you know, quality firearms when they're out hunting or target shooting, and this immunity legislation is just, it's a disgrace. And the way that the NRA has gone about and the industry has gone about lobbying this bill is classic bait and switch arguments. I mean, they're claiming on the one hand that they're merely trying to protect the industry from these predatory lawsuits and predatory plaintiff's attorneys who have sued the industry, you know, as a whole, and whose claims have been thrown out of court. Yet on the other hand, you look at the wording of the statute; it goes much further than that simple argument.
Bob, I want to ask a little bit about you, because you are, to say the least, a very interesting character here. I'm wondering, at what point did you change your position on this from gun lobbyist to whistleblower? What inspired that change?
Well, it wasn't a sudden change. I mean, if you look back at my record, many years working with the industry, I was always pushing from the inside for change. I was one of the prime architects of the industry's voluntary program to provide child safety locks with all new guns sold. That was applauded and endorsed by President Clinton back in 1997. So I've got kind of a long history here of advocating change, and it wasn't until probably about 2 years ago when I saw the politics changing in Washington, and I realized that this industry was just not going to do what most responsible industries do from taking voluntary action to clean up the bad actors that everybody knows about in the industry. And so I decided that I had a moral responsibility to come forward and tell the courts, tell the legislatures, tell Congress, you know, what I knew and what I understood.
Yeah, I have to say, when I read the affidavit that you filed in a suit in California against a gun maker, you get the sense, or at least I got the sense, that here's someone who's kind of squirming a little bit about what he was privy to as a gun lobbyist for all those years, who tried to change the organization from within and simply wasn't able to.
Well, the industry is made up of some very, very good, honest, hardworking people, and it's only a small percentage of dealers, of distributors, and some bad apple manufacturers that really cause, you know, a lion's share of the problem. And I think that there are people that are leaders within the industry right now that would be more than willing to come forward and institute changes, but they're being held hostage. They're being held hostage by the NRA, by other leading companies that do not want to change, and they're afraid that if they do take positive action, that they will be boycotted, that the NRA will come after them. We saw that happen a couple of years ago with Smith & Wesson. It almost destroyed that company. And there just needs to be some light of day here a little bit. And the American people need to know what this industry knows and what they can do to help solve the problem of gun violence.
Connection listeners, we are exploring the issue of gun control from a different perspective this hour. With the House of Representatives now on record prohibiting lawsuits aimed at gun makers, is this a dangerous precedent that leaves victims of violence nowhere to turn? Or is it needed to protect the gun makers and distributors who do follow the rules? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection. We're exploring the issue of immunity for gun makers with my guest, Robert Ricker, a former gun lobbyist turned whistleblower. We're asking if the gun industry should get the kind of federal protection not afforded to makers of tobacco or alcohol, or toys or cars, for that matter. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bob, I want to ask you, there did seem to be a moment after Columbine when people on both sides of the issue were genuinely looking for common ground. There were a number of lawsuits filed. I'm curious as to what happened to them and what happened to the search for common ground here.
Well, you're correct that following Columbine, there was a move not only within the gun industry but also within the Clinton administration to try to find some common ground and try to work on some areas that both the industry and law enforcement could concentrate on. And there were about five or six different proposals that were agreed upon. But again, as those proposals made their way through through Congress, you know, the NRA stepped in and was able to stop progress on in those areas. And the lawsuits that had been filed at that around the same period of time, for a few months prior to Columbine, those lawsuits, the one lawsuit that was filed by the city of Chicago, that lawsuit is still active and is still proceeding. And
would it go away if this passes the Senate?
Yes, if this bill passes in the Senate, it would go away. All of the lawsuits would go away. And several that had were filed early on have also made their way through the courts and were dismissed by the courts based upon certain principles of law. However, there are still a handful of cases that still remain and are still proceeding. I testified last week in a trial up in Brooklyn, New York, that is being brought by the NAACP against the firearms industry. And that case is now in trial. But again, all of these cases would have to be dismissed if this if these bills pending before Congress now become law.
Bob, you said that about 1% of the dealers account for about 50% or 57% actually of the guns that are used to commit crime. So shouldn't it be fairly easy to find those dealers and shut them down? And wouldn't it be in the best interest of the industry to do that on its own?
Well, I think it would, clearly. I mean, it would be very easy for the manufacturers and distributors to identify these bad apple dealers. And at least they should inquire as to what is happening at those particular gun shops. Why are their guns ending up in crime more, you know, disproportionately to let's say other types of gun shops, but it's this attitude that has prevailed within the industry that they don't want to know. The manufacturers, they're content with this idea that once the truck leaves the shipping dock with the guns, their responsibility ends. And they reason that if they do look, if they do try to find out, if they do try to do something proactively, then they will be admitting that they have responsibility. And that's where the gun lawyers have come in and shut down all chance of internal voluntary reform.
I have another guest this hour I want to bring into the conversation now. Joseph Olson is professor of law at the Hamline University School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Joe.
Hello there.
I want to ask you about this legislation because I'm wondering, first of all, if there are any other industries that have this kind of blanket protection. You think about what a litigious society we are in general. It seems almost un-American, you know, not to be able to sue somebody.
Well, you have to understand what the legislation does. For one thing, there never was and isn't now a right to successfully sue a maker of products for another's criminal misuse. When I was in law school, the classic example of a tort situation where you did not have probable cause, which is an essential element of bringing a tort action, is where the criminal activity of another person intervened. For example, someone uses a acetylene torch to break into a safe. You know, it's not the torch manufacturer produces a legitimate product, puts it into the marketplace for legitimate use. One of the people who acquires it uses it for an illegitimate purpose. That is what we call a supervening, intervening cause. And it is the cause of the harm, not the manufacturer of the product. So
well, but wait a minute, Joe.
Never been a right to do this.
Okay, but isn't this the only consumer product that is specifically designed to kill? I mean, a car is not?
No, actually, it's not specifically designed to kill. What guns are designed to do is to discharge a projectile downrange.
What the I can tell you're a lawyer, Joe.
Well, hang on. No, this is true. You know, I have probably fired
and an NRA
10,
member.
Thousand. What is this group libel? You know, I'm an NRA member. So what? I'm also a member of the American Bar Association. You know, the organization that I belong to has nothing to do with my academic qualifications or what I'm telling you right now. I've probably fired 10,000 rounds out of my firearms. Not one of them has ever killed anyone. They punched holes in paper. They've knocked over tin cans. They've broken rocks in half.
A firearm is designed
to discharge a projectile.
Okay, but do you take the basic point, Joe?
Just as a hammer can be used to kill.
Okay, but do you take the basic point that there perhaps should be more responsibility by the industry to police itself?
Well, let's take a look at what the bill does. What the bill does is it prohibits lawsuits on the basis that of the harm caused by criminal or unlawful misuse when the product functions and designed as it was designed and intended. So if the gun shoots, which is what guns are designed to do, and someone decides to misuse it, the manufacturer is provided with immunity. It specifically does not provide them with any immunity where the product is sold in a situation where you know or should know that it would be used in a crime or used in a manner which unreasonably causes risk to others. It specifically says that. It provides no liability where you have violated a state or federal statute in doing so. It provides no liability where you have breached a contract or warranty in connection with the product. And lastly, it provides no liability for your ordinary product liability tort lawsuit where damages have resulted from defective design or manufacture of the product when used as intended. You know, this only deals with one situation, which is the situation where you're trying to blame one party for another party's criminal misuse. And that has never been a winner, Joe.
I'm sorry, you're wrong on that, Joe. If you look at the language of the bill.
I've got it right here.
And look at that phrase, when used as intended. And that's the carte blanche phrase for the firearms industry because they can put in their gun manuals.
They're not intended to be used to rob banks.
Well, they could put complicated instructions on how to use a firearm that would give that firearm manufacturer blanket immunity if that firearm were to, let's say, fall out of my pocket and shoot and kill someone.
Well, the courts are going to determine what designed and intended means, and I seriously doubt that any judge is going to let the industry get away with that. It is designed and intended to discharge a projectile downrange in legitimate activities. That's what I'm certain it will be held to mean.
But that's why
over half of these lawsuits, and in fact every one of the lawsuits based on normal tort principles, has been dismissed.
But isn't the
this
whole
is
point
not a winner?
Isn't the whole point, Joe, to keep these suits from coming to court?
Well, that's exactly what Congress is supposed to do. Congress has power under the Constitution to regulate interstate commerce. Do you know why they were given that power? Because states were passing laws and putting unreasonable burdens on interstate commerce, such as a fee to import goods into one state from another. The Constitution was drafted. Congress was given power to regulate interstate commerce. Now, what we have here is a coordinated plan to go into every state in the union to bankrupt the industry, whether you win or not. It doesn't matter whether the plaintiffs win any of these cases. They are causing enormous damage to the industry, a national industry, an industry in interstate commerce, and they're trying to do so on the basis of legal theories that have never won anywhere. As I said, half of these lawsuits have been dismissed.
As a lawyer,
all the tort lawsuits have been dismissed. It is appropriate for Congress to step in. It is appropriate for Congress to step in because someone is out there doing this to this industry. No one is out there doing this to the getaway car industry.
Okay, Bob, maybe a quick response, and then we want to go to our phones.
Joe, you know as well as I do as a lawyer that a lawyer cannot ethically file a lawsuit against someone hoping to bankrupt that person. You can't do it. You could file ethics charges against all of these plaintiffs' lawyers. There have never been any ethics charges filed against any of these lawyers. Secondly, the lawsuits that have been dismissed there is a mechanism for the defendants who prevail to file charges under the rules of court if these lawsuits are frivolous. And again, none of these in any of the lawsuits that have been dismissed have there been any allegations that the lawsuits were frivolous. This is a smokescreen that has been invented by the NRA to get this sweeping immunity for their buddies in the industry.
All right. I'm sure neither of you will be surprised to hear that we have a lot of callers who want to get in on the conversation. Let's go first to Raleigh, North Carolina, and hear from Bob. Hello, Bob.
Hello. It's nice to talk to you, and thanks for covering the subject on the air. A couple of comments, then a question. I think that we need to defeat this immunity bill now. The public memory is short, and if this thing goes through, it's going to take a long time to clean up the problems that come out of it. The NRA has managed to buy the Congress and promote the guise of Second Amendment protection and a free market for guns. But in fact, I think the protection of gun rights is not exclusive of gun safety legislation or reasonable control of the distribution of guns or the rights of individuals to go to court. If somebody's got a problem, that's how we address it in the United States, is going to court. Mr. Olson, I think, is kidding us a little bit when he at first tries to water down the meaning of the bill and yet values it so much that he'll fight for it to this extent. It's up to the courts to decide each tort suit on its own specifics. For instance, when kiddie toys are sold at a toy distributor, if there's a problem with the toy, it's then up to the parent to take it back, take it to court, and address the manufacturer or the distributor or wherever they got the toy, and try to address their grievance that way. It's not up to the Congress to abridge those rights.
Okay,
so
thanks.
Why shouldn't it be the same for guns?
Thanks for the call, Bob. We appreciate hearing from you. Joe?
Well, actually, Bob, if the toy is defective or if the firearm is defective, that is that, it is defective in design or manufacture when not misused, you can bring it back to the manufacturer, any manufacturer, and they will take back defective products. The problem here is we have products that aren't defective, and the attempt is to hold the manufacturers liable for someone else's misconduct. You know, that has never been the law. That is not the law. That is why these cases are being dismissed all over the country. And Congress is simply stepping in and protecting interstate commerce, which is its legitimate job, from being impaired by all of these loser lawsuits. Now, if you have 50 states and you throw enough mud at the wall, something's going to stick, and that's going to impair interstate commerce. Congress has a right and, in fact, a duty to step in this situation, and if this was happening to the automobile industry, they would do exactly the same thing.
You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Bob, what about that? We've heard from some that that blaming the gun manufacturers for what criminals do is like blaming drunk driving accidents on General Motors. What's wrong with that argument?
I don't buy that analogy. What you have here is the better analogy is it would be like blaming automobile manufacturers when they don't make crash-worthy vehicles. I mean, no one ever intends for an automobile to be crashed. You don't go out and buy a car so you can go crash it into something, a brick wall or another automobile. Yet automobile manufacturers are required to build their cars in such a manner that it doesn't create an unreasonable danger to the passenger or the driver if that automobile should be in a crash. They're required to do things like put airbags in cars, seat belts, other things. I mean, a gun manufacturer does not build a gun intending it to be used in crime. Yet, what the theory of these lawsuits are is that the manufacturer, understanding that guns are going to be used in crime, need to engage in certain procedures to help guard against that. That's what these lawsuits are about.
Well, Bob has switched gears here. First, he talks about a defective product, and he says if you're going to drive down the road in the car, and this goes back to Henningsen versus Bloomfield Motors in the 30s. if you're going to manufacture a car that people are going to ride in, the wheels can't fall off, the steering wheel can't go through your chest when you have a 5-mile-an-hour crash, that's a defective product. To the extent that firearms are defective, that is, you pick up your firearm, you aim it at the paper target at the end of the range, you pull the trigger and it blows up in your hand, there is tort liability. There always has been tort liability. This bill makes no change in that. Matter of fact, it specifically says that it does not include defective products. The only thing the bill does is enshrine the rule of proximate cause, which has been the rule for well over 100 years in tort cases, that one party is not responsible for the criminal misuse made by another party. That's why these lawsuits have been defeated in state after state after state. That's why it's appropriate for Congress to step in and put an end to this, because it is protecting legitimate interstate commerce.
Joe, when the firearms manufacturers engage in unlawful distribution and marketing-type practices, you're saying that,
those theories
should not be, you shouldn't be able to go to court and sue a company when they engage in certain types of wrongful distribution practices?
Yeah, you're saying that they are violating a federal or state statute and they're acting unlawfully. If they're acting unlawfully, then the law should deal with them. The problem here is that these folks are trying to do a very, very undemocratic end run around the legislatures. Legislatures in every state and Congress have considered repeatedly the rules with regard to the sale of firearms. This is not a hidden agenda. Legislators have looked at it. They have decided not to do these things.
Well,
the people who lost that fight are unhappy about it.
We'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us. We are looking into the federal legislation that has just passed the House that would throw out pending lawsuits against gun makers and prohibit future ones. Connection listeners, is that protection that needs to be there, or is it a dangerous precedent? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection on NPR. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection. We're continuing the conversation now on the newly approved House resolution offering blanket immunity from lawsuits aimed at gun makers, with Robert Ricker, who is a former gun lobbyist and is now on record in support of a suit against a California gun manufacturer. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bob, I wanted to ask you about a comment that Joe made in our last segment about the fact that a lot of these lawsuits have been dropped or have been thrown out of court. And I'm wondering why you think they haven't held up.
Well, because they were based upon traditional common law legal theories, and the courts they've looked at the facts of the particular cases that were before them, applied the law, and found no basis for liability. I mean, it's as simple as that. And that happens every day in courts, you know, across this country. There's always a winner and a loser in a lawsuit, and the plaintiffs don't win all the time. The question is, and I think where the general public needs to weigh in here is the fact that traditionally in our judicial system that we have in this country, people are allowed to bring new and novel theories to court and to have their day in court, just like Detective Lemangelo. I mean, here's a situation where you had a gun dealer who knew when he was making that sale, when he's helping these people engage in illegal activity, when he collected those thousands of dollars and put it in his cash register, and then had sort of a pangs of his conscience and called ATF after the fact. I mean, those are facts that need to be considered by a jury and by a judge, and just for Congress to step in and say, well, You know, it's been pretty tough on the gun industry the last few years. They've had a series of lawsuits filed against them. We're going to give them, we're going to help them out. We're going to give them a free pass so that doesn't happen again. I just don't think that's doesn't fit in our American way. I mean, we saw back in the 50s when Congress and when state legislatures wouldn't deal effectively with racial discrimination. A case was filed, in court. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it had a dramatic impact on changing the way our schools are run and operated, and how we can't discriminate against people on the basis of race. So this is just some of these cases have new and novel theories, but I think as a lawyer, that they need to be tested in court, and some are going to win, and some are going to lose.
Let's go back to North Carolina, Asheboro this time, where Robert is phoning in. Hello, Robert.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment. I do support protection for the gun makers, based simply on the fact that our Constitution, the Founding Fathers, established the right to own and bear arms. And I'm not surprised that some enterprising individual come along and said, well, then fine, I'll make the guns. I don't think they should be blamed for it. If you're going to blame anybody, let's go back and blame the Founding Fathers. They're the ones that gave us the right to own and bear arms. And I think that it's ridiculous for an attorney to come along and want to back somebody up that thinks they can sue and blame their a criminal act from somebody that shoots an officer try to use this as a way of making money. Now, that's the way I see it. I think that some of these attorneys are ambulance chasers, and I think that's wrong. But, because we live in a democratic society, they have that right.
All right, Robert, we appreciate the call. Bob, to be fair, though, if I'm understanding you correctly, it's not necessarily the fact that these gun makers are making guns, but that they are not then sufficiently concerned about what happens to the guns after they leave the factory doors.
Right. They're not living up to their responsibility to make sure that the guns are marketed and distributed in a responsible fashion or a responsible manner. And it gets back to what we talked about earlier, this 1 to 1.5% of bad apple gun dealers, that the manufacturers, in my opinion, just can't say, well, we make a lawful product that's, the right to keep and bear arms. I agree with that. It's protected by the Constitution. And then that's it. I mean, we're gonna load these guns on a truck, and then when that truck leaves our loading dock, our responsibility ends. And I don't think that is the way responsible corporate America now operates in 2003. Maybe in the 1950s, in the 1960s, that was, it may have been a different story. You could deny liability on those things, but you look at other industries. You look at the alcohol industry, for example. I mean, they're working together with their critics, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, to try to reduce drunken driving or alcohol-related automobile accidents. They sponsor public service announcements. Even in, you walk into a liquor store, you're going to see some sort of a poster or some sort of a plea, be responsible, don't drink and drive. The tobacco industry, right now, they pay their outlets, stores that sell cigarettes, they pay them incentives for making sure that they aren't selling cigarettes to minors or people that aren't old enough to smoke. I mean, we can't just take one industry and isolate them out here on the side and say, listen, you guys don't have to be responsible. And then everybody else has to live by a different set of rules.
But there's no law that says they have to be responsible after they make the product according to the Constitution. I mean, if that's true, then everybody that makes a baby diaper or a wristwatch or anything else, if it's wrongfully used by some human being, then the manufacturer's got to be blamed for it. That's baloney.
No, you're jumping way ahead. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that I have the right to make handguns. I mean, the Constitution is directed at the people. It's not directed at an industry. Secondly, when you do, under our laws, under our tort system, when you undertake a certain activity, you have to do it in a responsible manner. Now, I'm saying sure, if I have a gun and I have it secured at home and I'm following all the rules and I'm a law-abiding citizen and someone breaks into my house and steals that gun and goes out into the street and shoots somebody, no, that manufacturer should not be held responsible in that type of a case. But in a case like Detective Lemangelo, where you had the manufacturers who know that there are bad apple dealers out there and continue to sell to bad apple dealers, and those bad apple dealers sell to criminals, then I think responsibility attaches. And I think that you're going to see, if Detective Lemangelo's case gets to the court and gets to the jury, you're going to see a judgment in his favor.
Thanks so much for the call, Robert. Let's go to Steve now, who is in Minocqua, Wisconsin. Hello, Steve.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. First point I'd like to make is the gentleman is talking about the gun industry and not taking any responsibility. And first of all, there are a lot of gun safety programs for youth hunters and other programs that the gun industry does sponsor and teach the young children how to use a gun responsibly. Secondly, my question is, we're going after the gun dealers for this, and we're trying to sue gun manufacturers, rather. Why aren't we suing the ATF for not doing their job and going after the bad gun dealers that they know about, and it's their responsibility, and it's the formation of a law enforcement entity that we support? Why aren't we doing that?
Well, as we know, and as the NRA knows, and as the industry knows, that ATF is seriously understaffed, underpaid, and underfunded and overworked. I mean, they do a tremendous job with the resources they have. But you know what? Every year up on Capitol Hill, when their budget comes up, you know who's sitting right there at the table asking that it be slashed? The National Rifle Association. For years, I first worked at the NRA back in 1981. And when I went to work there, one of my jobs was to make sure that ATF did not get the money that they needed. And it's disingenuous for Wayne LaPierre or for Charlton Heston to get on the air or to go on television and say, well, it's really ATF's fault. Because every year, they're there at Capitol Hill slashing their budget. They've never once gone up there and asked for more money for the ATF.
You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Thanks very much for the call, Steve. Bob, I want to ask how you see this issue playing out over the next number of months. Some might say, well, this is exactly why we have a Senate, which is viewed as a somewhat slower and more deliberative body, and particularly on constitutional matters. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, it's going to be close, Gail, whichever way the vote goes on this. And it's really going to depend upon who these senators hear from, their constituents. I mean, it's important that if you feel strongly that these statutes should not be passed, you need to get on the phone and you need to contact your senator. The NRA, on the other hand, they're sending out millions and millions of pieces of mail to their membership, and their membership is getting on the phone. They're sending emails, they're phoning, they're sending faxes into the Senate. So it's going to be a tough fight. It's going to be close, and how it's going to come out, I really don't know. But I think for the good of our country, I think that this particular piece of legislation is a bad idea.
Why is it, do you think, that it's been so difficult for some common ground to be found here? Why are we at this impasse?
Well, it's an emotional issue. I mean, the whole gun control debate for years has raged, here in our country, and it sort of ebbs and flows. You know, when you have horrific shootings like Columbine and those sorts of things, then you'll see a big push for more gun control, and then when you see conservatives being elected and taking control of legislatures, then you see the other side becomes more powerful. But it's a traditional hot blood issue. I mean, like abortion, and other issues like that. I mean, it's hard fought, and the problem is there are solutions. If smart people can sit down at a table, they can solve these things, and a lot of times what happens is the rhetoric gets in the way. You've got both extremes. You've got people on both sides kind of screaming over the people in the middle, I think it's important for people to kind of leave the rhetoric at the door, come on in to the table, sit down, and I think you can do some things to solve some of the problems.
If I'm remembering the numbers correctly, there were 258 votes affirmative in the House for this legislation. So clearly it wasn't terribly close, and I'm struck by that because this vote came originally, I think it was supposed to be offered last October and was postponed, and yet still it's not that much past the time when we were watching daily, almost daily, sniper shootings that terrorized Washington in particular for weeks.
That's correct. It's interesting, the House vote, because it was called, and there were some talk in the halls that the reason that some of the legislators wanted to vote when it happened was as sort of a pre-event to the NRA's annual convention, which is being held, I believe, next week down in Orlando, Florida, that the NRA really wanted to go down to their annual meeting with a success with this vote in the House. And I think a lot of members who are more moderate, both Democrats and Republicans, we're approaching it from the perspective, well, gee, if the first vote is in the House, I can vote for this bill, and then I'm not going to have to worry about any backlash from the pro-gun side politically. And I know that in the Senate they're going to slow it down and take more time, and that a lot of the bad things that are in the bill will come out at that time. So I think you had that dynamic working in there, that the politicians were going to take advantage of this vote. They could get in a vote, and it would be something that the NRA would look very kindly on, and then worry about stopping it later on down the road when it gets over to the Senate.
And are you hopeful about that, or do you think it really is a coin toss?
Well, I think it's close. I think they've already got 52 co-sponsors in the Senate, which is more than enough votes to pass it. However, there are some rules of the Senate that make it more difficult for the bill to come up on the floor for an up or down vote, and that's really where the battle's going to be.
All right, Bob, we will be watching it, as I know you will be. Thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Bob Ricker spent his career as a lobbyist for the gun industry. We were joined earlier by David Limoncello, who retired last year from the Orange, New Jersey Police Department, by John Lowy, attorney at the Brady Center in Washington, D.C., and by Joseph Olson, a law professor at Hamline University Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Support.